The cottage, once it was repainted and furnished with discards from the big house, was by Mark's standards palatial and marvellously free of vermin and cockroaches. It was less than half a mile from the main house, and his hours became as irregular as those of his master, his position each day more trusted and naturally integrated into the household. His duties came to cover the entire spectrum, from speech-writing and researching, answering all correspondence that was not important enough for the general's own hand, operating the household accounts, to merely sitting quietly sometimes when Sean Courtney needed somebody to talk to, and acting as a sounding board for arguments and ideas. Yet there was still time for his old love of reading. There were thousands of volumes that made up the library at Emoyeni, and Mark took an armful of them down to the cottage each evening and read until the early hours, devouring with omnivorous appetite history, biography, satire, political treatise, Zane Grey, Kipling, and Rider Haggard. Then suddenly there was a new spirit of excitement and upheaval in Emoyeni as the next session of Parliament approached. This meant that the household must uproot itself and move almost 1,000 miles south to Cape Town. Lightly, Ruth Courtney referred to this annual political migration as the Great Trek. But the description was justified, for it meant moving the family, 15 of the senior servants, 3 automobiles, 12 horses, all the clothing, silver, glassware, papers, books, and other incidentals that would be necessary to sustain in the correct style a busy social and political season of many months, while General Courtney and his peers conducted the affairs of the nation. It meant also closing Emoyeni and opening the house in Newlands, below the squat bulk of Table Mountain. In the middle of all this frantic activity, Storm Courtney arrived home from the grand tour of the British Isles and the continent, on which she and Irene Luchars had been chaperoned by Irene's mother. In her last letter to Ruth Courtney, Mrs. Luchars had admitted herself to be both physically and mentally exhausted. "You will never know, my dear, the terrible weight of responsibility I have been under. We have been followed across half the world by droves of eager young men, Americans, Italians, Frenchmen, counts, barons, sons of industrialists, and even the son of the dictator of a South American republic. The strain was such that at one period I could bear it no longer and locked both the girls in their room. It was only later that I discovered that they had escaped by means of a fire escape and danced until the following morning at some disreputable boîte de nuit in Montparnasse." With the tact of a loving wife, Ruth refrained from showing the letter to Sean Courtney, and so he prepared to welcome his daughter with all the enthusiasm of a doting father, unclouded by awareness of her recent escapades. Mark was, for once, left out of the family preparations, and he watched from the library window when Sean handed his wife into the rolls. He was dressed like a suitor, in crisply starched flyaway collar, a gay silk cravat, dark blue suit with white carnation in the buttonhole, and a beaver tilted jauntily over one eye. His beard was trimmed and shampooed, and there was a merry anticipatory sparkle in his eyes, and he twirled his cane lightly as he went round to his own seat. The rolls purred away, almost 2 hours ahead of the time when the mail ship was scheduled to berth at No. 1 Wharf. It was followed at a respectful distance by the second rolls, which would be needed for the conveyance of Storm Courtney's baggage. Mark lunched alone in the study and then worked on, but his concentration was broken by the imminent arrival of the returning cavalcade, and when it came, he hurried to the windows. He caught only a glimpse of Storm as she left the car and danced up the front steps hand in hand with her mother. They were followed immediately by the general, his cane snapping a staccato beat off the marble as he hurried to match their swiftness. On his face he wore an expression that tried to remain severe and stern, but kept breaking into a wide, beaming grin. Mark heard the laughter and the excited murmur of the servants assembled to greet her in the entrance hall, and Storm's voice giving a new sweet lilt to the cadence of the Zulu language as she went to each of them in turn. Mark returned to his open books, but did not look down at them. Instead, he was savouring that one glimpse he had had of Storm. She had grown somehow lovelier. He had not believed it possible, but it had happened. It was as though the divine essence of young womanhood had been distilled in her. All the gaiety and grace, all the warmth and smoothness, the texture of skin and silken hair, the perfect moulding of limb and the delicate sculpturing of feature, the musical lilt of her voice clear as the ring of crystal, the dancing grace of her movements, the very carriage of the small, perfect head on bare brown shoulders. Mark sat bemused, acutely aware of the way in which the whole huge house had changed its mood since she entered it, and become charged with her spirit, as though it had been waiting for this moment. Mark had excused himself from dinner that evening, not wanting to intrude on the family's first evening together. He intended going down to the drill hall for the weekly muster, and afterwards he would dine with some of the other young bachelor officers. At 4 o'clock he left the house, through a side entrance, and went down to the cottage to bath and change into his uniform. He was thundering out of the gates of Emoyeni on the aerial square 4 when he remembered that the general had asked for the railway report to be left on his desk. In the distraction of Storm's arrival, he had forgotten it, and now he swung the heavy machine into a tight turn and tore back up the driveway. In the paved kitchen yard, he pulled the motorcycle up on its stand and went in through the back door. He was standing at the library table with the report in his hands, glancing through it quickly to check his own notations, when suddenly the latch on the door clicked. He laid aside the report and turned just as the door swung open. This close, Storm Courtney was lovelier still. She was 3 quick, light paces into the room before she realised she was not alone, and she paused, startled, poised with the grace of a gazelle on the point of flight. One hand flew to her mouth, and her fingers were delicately tapered with long nails that gleamed like pink mother-of-pearl. She touched her lips with the tip of one finger. The lip trembled slightly, wet and smooth and glistening, and her eyes were huge and dark, fearful blue. She looked like a little girl, frightened and alone. Mark wanted to reassure her, to protect her from her own distress, to say something to comfort her, but he found he could not move or speak. He need not have worried. Her distress lasted only a fleeting beat of time, just long enough for her to realise that the source of her alarm was a tall young man, dashing in the dress and uniform he wore, a uniform that set off the slim, graceful body, a uniform emblazoned with badges of courage and of responsibility. Subtly, with barely a shadow of movement, her whole poise changed. The finger on her lip now touched one cheek with an arch gesture, and the trembling lip stilled and parted slightly into a thoughtful pout. The huge eyes, no longer fearful, almost disappeared behind drooping lids, and then examined Mark critically, lifting her chin to look up into his face. Her stance changed also, one hip thrusting forward an inch, the twin mounds of her breasts lifting and pressing boldly against the gossamer silk of her bodice. The tender, taunting line of her lips was enough to make Mark's breath catch in his throat. "Hello," she said. Her voice, although low and throaty, bounced the word off Mark's heart, drawing it out into 2 syllables that seemed to hang in the air seconds later. "Good evening, Miss Courtney," he answered her, surprised that his voice came out level and assured. It was the voice that triggered her memory, and the blue eyes flew wide as she stared at him. Slowly her surprise turned to angry outrage. The eyes snapped sparks, and 2 bright scarlet blotches of crimson burned suddenly on the smooth, almost waxy perfection of her cheeks. "You?" she asked incredulously. "Here?" "I'm afraid so," he agreed, and her consternation was so comical that he grinned at her, his own misgivings evaporating. Suddenly he felt relaxed and at his ease. "What are you doing in this house?" She drew herself up to her full height, and her manner became frostily dignified. The full effect was spoiled by the fact that she had to look up at him, and that her cheeks still burned with agitation. "I am your father's personal assistant now," and he smiled again. "However, I'm sure you will soon become reconciled to my presence." "We will see about that," she snapped. "I shall speak to my father." "Oh, well, I was led to understand that you and the general had already discussed my employment, or rather, my unemployment."
I said
Storm, and then closed her mouth firmly, the colour spreading from her cheeks down her throat, as she remembered with sudden acute discomfort the whole episode. The humiliation was still so intense that she felt herself wilting like a rose on a summer's day, and a small choke of self-pity constricted the back of her throat. It was enough that it had happened, that instead of her father's unquestioning support, something she had been accustomed to since her first childhood memories, he had told her angrily that she had acted like a spoiled child, that she had shamed him by misusing his power and influence, and that the shame had been made more intense by the way she had used it without his knowledge, by sneaking behind his back, as he put it. She had been frightened, as she always was by his anger, but not seriously disturbed. It was almost 10 years since he had last lifted a hand to her. A true lady shows consideration to all around her, no matter what their colour or creed or station. She had heard it often before, and now her fear was turning to irritation. "Oh, la-di-da, Pater, I'm not a child any more," she flounced. "He was insolent, and anybody who is insolent to me will damn well pay for it." "You have made 2 statements there," the general noted with deceptive calm, "and both of them need correction. If you are insolent, then you will get back insolence. And you are a child still." He rose from his chair behind the desk, and he was huge, like a forest oak, like a mountain. "One other little thing. Ladies do not swear, and you are going to be a lady when you grow up, even if I have to beat it into you." As he took her wrist, she suddenly realized with a sense of incredulous dismay what was about to happen. It had not happened since she was 14 years of age, and she had believed it would never happen again. She tried to pull away, but his strength was enormous, and as he lifted her easily under one arm and carried her to the leather couch, she let out her first squeal of fear and outrage. It changed swiftly to real anguished howls as he positioned her carefully across his lap and swept her skirts up over her head. Her pantaloons were of blue crepe de chine, with little pink roses decorating the target area, and his palm, horny and hard, snapped over the tight double bulge of her buttocks with a sharp, rubbery crack. He kept it up until the howling and kicking subsided into heart-racking sobs, and then he lowered her skirts and told her quietly, "If I knew where to find him, I'd send you to apologize to that young man." Storm remembered that threat and felt a moment of panic. She knew her father was still quite capable of making her apologize, even now, and she nearly turned and rushed out of the library. It required a supreme effort once more to draw herself up and lift her chin defiantly. "You are right," she said coldly. "The hiring and firing of my father's servants is not a subject with which I should concern myself. Now, if you'd kindly stand aside."
"Of course, forgive me,"
still smiling. Mark bowed extravagantly and made way for her to pass. She tossed her head and swished her skirts as she passed him, and in her agitation went to the wrong shelves. It was some little time before she realized that she was studying intently a row of bound copies of 10-year-old parliamentary white papers, but she would not admit her mistake and humiliate herself further. Furiously she pondered her next sally, picking and discarding 6 disparaging remarks before settling on, "I would be obliged if in future you would address me only when it is absolutely necessary, and right at this moment I should like to be alone." She spoke without interrupting her perusal of the white papers. There was no reply, and she turned haughtily. "Did you hear what I said?" Then she paused. She was alone. He had gone silently, and she had not even heard the click of the latch. He had not waited to be dismissed, and Storm felt quite dizzy with anger. Now a whole parade of brilliant and biting insults came readily to her lips, and frustration spiced her anger. She had to do something to vent it, and she looked around for something to break, and then remembered just in time that it was Sean Courtney's library, and everything in it was treasured. So instead she racked her brain for its foulest oath. "Bloody hell!" she stamped her foot, and it was entirely inadequate. Suddenly she remembered her father's favourite. "The bastard!" she added, rolling it thunderously around her tongue, as Sean did, and immediately she felt better. She said it again, and her anger subsided, leaving an extraordinary new sensation. There was a disturbing heat in that mysterious area between navel and knees. Flustered and alarmed, she hurried out into the garden. The short, glowing tropical dusk gave the familiar lawns and trees an unreal stage-like appearance, and she found herself almost running over the spongy turf, as though to escape from her own sensations. She stopped beside the lake, and her breathing was quick and shallow, not entirely from her exertions. She leaned on the railing of the bridge, and in the rosy light of sunset her reflection was perfectly mirrored in the still pearly waters. Now that the disturbing new sensation had passed, she found herself regretting that she had fled from it. Something like that was what she had hoped for when... She found herself thinking again of that awkward and embarrassing episode in Monte Carlo. Goaded on by Irene Duchard's, teased and tempted, she had been made to feel inadequate because she lacked the experience of men that Irene boasted of. Chiefly to spite Irene and to defend herself against her jibes, she had slipped away from the casino with the young Italian count and made no protest when he parked the Bugatti among the pine trees on the high-level road above Cap Ferrat.